Welcome, everyone. Great to have you here. My name is Cortland Dahl. I think I probably know most of you, but I have a sneaking suspicion that some of you might be joining for the first time. We just had a lot of new people who have joined us in the past month. So welcome if you are joining this Dharma Geek session for the first time and are new to the Vajrayana Online program. It's a delight to have you here. So as I said, I'm Cortland Dahl. I'm one of the Tergar instructors, and I've been leading these Dharma Geek sessions. So just a brief overview of what we do in these sessions, and then we'll dive in and get started. So typically we start with a little bit of practice, and most of the session we try to really pick up on some key points and go very deep into whatever those points might be. So at times I've gone kind of step by step through specific texts, kind of trying to get at some of the key ideas and key principles. In some cases, as we'll do today, I'm going to talk about a very specific kind of high level concept from the tradition. So today, I'm going to talk specifically about a topic that Rinpoche teaches in the course, which is the distinction between experience and realization. So I'll talk a lot about that later. But so sometimes we do something like that, kind of taking a key concept. But even though I call these Dharma Geek sessions, I really, for me, what has always been the most interesting, most important part of my own journey has really been the meditative process and experience. So I like to think that this isn't just kind of academic, you know, scholastic theory. It's really just going deeper, taking some kind of key essential points from the tradition, and just going deeper, spending more time than we often do in these kinds of contexts. So today, I think, is one that if you've been with Vajrayana Online for some time, we've probably talked about this at various points along the way, but it's just an incredibly important point. And the teachings that Rinpoche is giving, the teachings from the tradition, are really helpful for practice, really helpful, especially in discerning what do we really need to keep our eye on in practice? Where are we really oriented and pointed in the right direction? And where might we be getting a little sidetracked and sometimes seduced by the ups and downs of experience? So I found these teachings profoundly helpful in my own practice, in retreat, in daily practice, and even in daily life, applying teachings in daily life, and hopefully we'll be able to explore them together in a way that will be useful for you as well. And usually I just begin with a little practice. So if it's okay with you, we can start there, just root and ground our time together in some meditative experience. So we'll start with a short meditation and then we will move on to the topic. So as you can see, people are saying hello in the chat. We can maybe just very briefly before we get started, if you want to just say where you're joining from. We've already heard from a few people from, let's see, Portugal, a few of you here in the US, and yes, Diane, great suggestion. We have just these horrible conflicts in the world now, in Ukraine, in the Middle East, in Israel. So let's all keep our brothers and sisters. We actually have groups and Tergar students in both of these places. So not only them, but everybody who's struggling, let's all keep them in mind. So amazing. Look at you, all over the world, Germany, Canada, more places in the US, Spain, Italy, Denmark, Mexico. Yeah, wonderful. France. Welcome, everybody. So just a delight. That's one of the things I love about our programs and community is just connecting with people from all over the world. So wherever you are in the world, welcome, and really happy you joined us. So let's get started with a little meditation. You're all experienced meditators, so just get into a comfortable posture. And a few key things about the posture specific to nature of mind practice, as we're learning in Mahamudra, there are some unique things that are a little bit different than what you might be used to. So the first is you want to have a straight spine and upright. That's pretty normal. But in Mahamudra, in these nature of mind traditions, really being at ease is very, very important. There's a sense of naturalness ease of letting be, of dropping the doing and just being. So see if you can tap into that quality within your own body, your physical posture. You might want to take a few slow, calming breaths. And see if you can get in touch with this quality of being, of effortless presence. Another important, unique point about the posture that might be new is that we generally keep our eyes open in nature of mind practice. So you can experiment with that. Just allow your eyes to be very gently open. Your gaze natural and relaxed, not needing to focus on anything in particular. And for a few moments, just sit. You don't even need to worry about paying attention to anything or doing anything with your mind. Give yourself permission to simply exist. Just be the you in this moment fully and completely. Now let's bring in an element of compassion. You might be familiar with this idea of bodhicitta, which is the motivation to help all beings, oneself included, to attain Buddhahood, to realize their true nature. But here we can have the special flavor of nature of mind by setting a clear intention and motivation, recognizing that all beings have this awakened nature, that pure, empty clarity of awareness itself. And you just form the motivation and the aspiration that everyone recognize that for themselves, and that we can have that be our guiding motivation for why we practice, to help bring more of that realization into the world. So just take a moment and see if you can set that compassionate motivation, recognizing that you and all other sentient beings have this awakened Buddha nature. And we all recognize that for ourselves. And once you feel that you've connected with that open-hearted motivation, drop back into awareness. Drop all the mental effort, even the impulse to meditate, whatever that might mean to you. And just rest naturally. Allow yourself, again, to simply be. No doing. Nothing to concentrate on, nothing to change, to fix, to improve. Everything you need is already here, so just rest in this moment of awareness. you will likely get distracted from time to time. That is completely normal. And as a meditator, when you notice you're distracted, you might have the impulse to do something with your mind, to focus on your breath, to chant a mantra, to do something else, or even just to kind of effortfully keep yourself from getting distracted. But see if you can let go of all of that effort. The moment you notice you've been lost, you are already back in awareness. You're already reconnected to the knowing quality of your own mind. There's nothing more you need to do. So just notice that and rest. Okay. So you can continue this experience of resting simply, effortlessly in awareness, even as we're talking and you're listening in this case, or at least right now. And that's kind of the cool thing about this tradition and this particular approach to meditation is that it really is simply about reconnecting with awareness. And we can do this while we're sitting still in meditation posture. But as you're listening, you can just as easily be continuing to just rest effortlessly in awareness as you listen, as you talk, as you move, as you, you know, as I'm sitting here and saying what I'm saying, I can do this just as easily now as I did a few minutes ago when we were meditating. So the whole idea is not necessarily easy, but it's very simple. It's just coming back to awareness. And in these nature of mind traditions, and Maha Mudra specifically, what begins to happen is that we are beginning to ground ourselves in awareness, and we basically learn to stabilize the experience through getting more and more familiar with what it's like to be in awareness, to be connected to awareness. And then through that grounding in awareness, we can actually start exploring what awareness actually is. And this gets into the practices of what we call shamatha and vipassana, which are kind of what we're talking about and you might be reading about in the course right now. Shamatha is just that grounding in awareness. It's learning to live in awareness, to be in that awareness. So awareness itself doesn't need to get more stable because awareness is always present. What's getting more stable is our ability to recognize awareness, our ability to have our conscious, lived, felt experience be grounded in that experience moment to moment. So that's what's growing more stable. It's not awareness itself, because as I said, awareness is always present. That's the element of what we call shamatha or calm abiding meditation, is just that process of getting increasingly familiar and increasingly grounded and stable and rooted in awareness. And then vipassana, this element of clear seeing that Rinpoche has been teaching about, is when we actually start seeing the very nature of that awareness. We start seeing in a clear way, what is actually the essence? What are the defining characteristics of that emptiness? Or sorry, of that awareness, and emptiness, of course, being one of those characteristics. So we start to both get more familiar with who we truly are and gain deep insight into the very nature of who we are. So one of the things that happens, and this will bring us to the topic we're discussing today, is in this process of growing more familiar with awareness, more grounded, and especially starting to wake up and gain insight into the very nature of awareness, which is kind of the heart of this whole tradition, all sorts of experiences begin to unfold. Some of those are what you might think of as the almost like the byproducts of the meditative process. Essentially, what's happening is our entire mind-body system, you know, in traditional Buddhist terms, we have this idea of the five skandhas. These are kind of the five different dimensions of our experience. We have our embodied experience. We have like the feelings, pleasure and pain, unpleasant, neutral sensations and feelings. We have all of the kind of the concepts, the sort of the labeling of the mind, the kind of concepts of the mind. We have all of these mental activities, and then we have consciousness itself. So basically, you have all of these interrelated processes that make up our conscious experience. And when we start this process of recognizing the very nature of awareness and getting grounded in that, this whole system basically begins to reformulate itself. It's almost a process, and it's sometimes referred to as a process of inner purification. The kind of the unwholesome qualities and some of the blockages and knots, even in our subtle energetic system, begin to loosen and open up. And some of the more positive qualities that are sort of latent and kind of buried beneath the surface, come more to the forefront. We experience them more consciously. But basically, the whole inner system, all of our mind and body and all of these interrelated processes, go through a pretty profound process of change and transformation and purification. This happens effortlessly. We don't need to make this happen. You don't need to do anything to kind of force the energies of the body in any particular way. You don't need to alter your breathing process. You don't need to kind of make any of this happen. It just begins to spontaneously work itself out. And that's the hallmark of Mahamudra and Dzogchen, is that it's spontaneous, it's effortless, it's natural. It all comes spontaneously from this process of getting in touch with awareness and the very nature of awareness. So as that happens, we experience all sorts of highs and lows of the meditative process itself. So sometimes they can be pleasant, sometimes intensely pleasant, sometimes they can be unpleasant, and sometimes intensely unpleasant. And none of this is neither good or bad. And in a sense, it's all positive, in that it's just the process of moving along the path. And it's very much like, we use this metaphor of the path, it's very much like an actual physical journey. If you're going somewhere, if you're going anywhere, and you're on a long trip and you're making an important journey, there are going to be all sorts of highs and lows along that journey, right? Mingyur Rinpoche gives the metaphor of traveling in Tibet, going to Lhasa, like if you're in Eastern Tibet, where you can imagine you're kind of crossing mountain ranges and it's very intensely, you know, kind of up and down. So on that journey, because you know you're going somewhere, and hopefully you know your destination, you view all of that ups and downs as part of the process. When you're kind of going up a mountain, you know, it's harder, you know, you have to work harder, but you know you're getting closer to the destination. So you don't think of that as a bad thing. You just know the up and the down is just part of that process. So you have all sorts of winding turns. You have all sorts of ups and downs. You have times where it's a beautiful sunny day, and you have times when it's stormy weather. Like if you're on a long journey, you just know that that's part of the journey. You expect it. So you're not, you know, it's maybe not so pleasant, and it might be more difficult when it's a storm or when you're trudging up a mountain or going through a swamp. But because you know where you're going, and because it's an expected part of the process, it's really much easier to navigate. Just the knowledge that that's part of the process itself makes it more manageable, and you know you're going to get through it, and you know that you need to do things like that to get to the desired destination. So the metaphor really holds here too. This is just the ups and downs of the inner terrain. We're kind of navigating the ups and downs of this inner process of transformation, this process of purification that naturally plays out. And if we know what that is and we know what to expect, then that isn't surprising to us, and we know how to deal with that. More importantly, again, just like the physical journey, You know when you're in the swamp, or you know even when you're at the peak of one of those mountain passes, you know that's not the destination. You know, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, in the middle of the US. If I'm going to whatever, I'm going to San Francisco, I know when I'm going through the Rockies, I might be at the peak of some beautiful mountain and have just some amazing vista that I've never seen before. And as beautiful as that is, I know that's not San Francisco, right? I know that that's not where I'm going. And so I might enjoy it, and I can enjoy the walk up the mountain and the beautiful view when I'm there, but I know that that's not where I'm going. So you need to let it come and let it go. And this is the problem with, or the challenge, I would say, with the spiritual journey, is that we have those moments when we get to the peak of the mountain. And this is the realm of experience versus realization. But sometimes we don't know how to discern whether it's the destination, in other words, what we're really aiming for in our practice, or it's just some temporary nice view, like, again, being at the top of the mountain, but not where we're actually going on our trip. So where we can get most sidetracked in our practice is we hit those beautiful, you know, high points in our practice, and we mistake that for the destination. That's when like a positive experience happens. Or the opposite of that, we end up in a swamp, or we end up in the middle of a, you know, a really long storm, and we think something has gone wrong. We think that we've made a mistake. We think we've gotten off track, when actually it's just an expected part of the journey. Both the peak of the mountain, being in the swamp, those are just completely normal, natural, expected parts of the journey. And neither of them are the destination, but we're expecting them. So the problem is when we don't know what to expect, or we don't know how to discern the destination from all of the things we're going to see along the way in the journey to the destination. This is exactly the reason why Rinpoche, and in the tradition, they're teaching this important distinction between experience and realization. So experience is a Tibetan word. It's translating a Tibetan word that many of you have probably heard, which is nyam. And it's a word that literally just means experience. It's actually the same word that we use when we translate practice. The term in Tibetan is nyam su len, which means literally to take into one's experience. Like we're taking a concept like impermanence or refuge or bodhicitta or emptiness, whatever. Practice, like using that term, is kind of taking that and integrating it, bringing it into our own inner experience. So it's not just a concept. So it's that same word. It's just experience. But here what it means is it means very specifically conditioned experience, meaning experience that is based on the complex interrelation of causes and conditions that are present in any given moment. So whatever you're experiencing right now, we're always having some experience. So you might be, obviously part of that experience is your sensory experience. You're hearing me, you're seeing me, you have everything going on in your environment. You have stuff that's going on in your body. You know, right now I have like a little pain in my shoulder. The rest of me feels pretty okay. I'm relaxed. You know, you might be well or feeling a little sick. You might feel relaxed, or you might feel tense. You might, in whatever the case, you have some physical experience that's going on. And then you might have your emotional experience, right? You might feel really calm and at ease. You might be having a rough time and have some other challenging things going on. You might have any number of more kind of the inner atmosphere of your emotional landscape can be changing. All of that is changing every moment. That is nyam, right? It's just the version of experience that we're having right now that is based on a very complex and ever-changing set of causes and conditions. So that, again, to use our analogy, that's like the journey. The circumstances are constantly changing. So the weather patterns, you know, you might be in a beautiful landscape one moment, and an hour later, you're in the same landscape, but suddenly it's a storm, right? Because the weather patterns have changed. Or the landscape itself is changing. You're on the plains versus the mountain. You're in a swamp versus a, you know, kind of a beautiful forest. Like the circumstances are constantly changing, and therefore your experience is going to be constantly changing. It's just going to look and feel different from moment to moment. So in the meditative journey, we have that same thing. I mean, that's just happening in life all the time. Life itself is conditioned. All these patterns of experience that are shifting and moving and changing. And that, of course, is equally going on in meditation, in our meditation practice. But once we start this inner process of meditation, and specifically once we get in touch with awareness and even the nature of awareness as we explore in these Mahamudra teachings, then there's kind of a particular version of that dynamic display of experience that begins to play out. And this is the peaks and valleys of the meditative experience. So on the positive end of the spectrum, we have all sorts of pleasant meditation experiences that can happen. So, you know, it can range from everything from just kind of feeling, you know, a little at ease. Maybe you just feel a little more relaxed than normal. Maybe you feel a little more peaceful. Maybe all of the chatter in your mind or the emotional turmoil in your experience eases up a little bit. Not necessarily disappears, but you just feel a little more chill than you normally do. It can range from that, something very subtle, to something very, very extreme. Like you can have a state of complete no thought, where like literally there is nothing, no emotional and thought activity going on in your mind. You can have an experience where it's just like ecstatic, where you literally feel like you want to get up and dance. You're just bursting out of your skin with kind of positive, happy, joyful energy. Or states of what we call clarity, where it can feel like somebody just dialed up the intensity of your sensory experience. Just everything feels so vivid, so bright. You feel so awake, right? So that can be a more extreme experience. So it can be everything from that, just very subtle, just a little bit different than your normal experience, to in some cases, something very dramatic. And in some cases, that even might last for a while. It can go on for hours or even days in some cases, where you just feel, you know, some powerful experience kind of moving through. So all of that is in the realm of what we call positive jnana, positive experiences that can happen. The traditional ones are, and this is, you'll hear this a lot in meditative traditions, are bliss, clarity, and non-thought. So these are kind of three things that I just mentioned in passing. So bliss is a term in Tibetan, the term is dewa, or in Sanskrit, some of you might have heard sukha. And it can mean that kind of ecstatic, almost physical bliss, like that quality that I mentioned, where it's almost like you're just bursting out of your skin with joy, like you might actually feel like you want to get up and start dancing around. But this same term, dewa or sukha, it can also mean a deep ease, like you just feel, I've arrived. I finally just feel completely at home in the world. Everything is okay. Everything is wonderful. You just feel deeply content. So it doesn't always have to be that physical ecstatic bliss. It can be almost like a mental sense of deep ease and contentment that can happen. So that's that space of what we usually translate as bliss, but could just be translated as ease or contentment as well in some cases. Clarity is that one I mentioned where it's like you feel intensely wakeful. Everything is vivid. Everything is crisp. All your senses are bright, and it just feels like you just turned up the intensity on your experience in a positive way. And non-thought is, again, where your mind just feels like somebody just like cleared out. It's almost like somebody just goes through and just did like a spring cleaning on your mind. It just feels so clear and clean and fresh. Your mind's not filled with the normal monkey mind stuff that's always happening, or a lot of emotional activity that might be happening. It just feels like inner space, like you just got completely cleaned out from the inside. So those are kind of the most important categories of these positive jnana. But just as frequent, and in some cases even more frequent, are the unpleasant jnana. And again, there's many, many, many versions of this that can happen. But the ones you hear about in meditative literature are dullness and agitation. agitation, you can imagine, is sort of the opposite of that non-thought. It's when your mind is just filled with activity. And actually, I think it's more than just, we tend to usually talk about a lot of thought activity. And as a meditator, that's maybe one of the most common forms. But it can be, there's other forms of agitation too. It can, you know, we can feel physical agitation, where it's just like you're, just like you can't settle. You just feel, you know, like you're just like you drank 10 cups of coffee. You can't settle down. Like there's just too much going on at a physical level, or too much emotional kind of ups and downs. Like the emotions are just kind of churning and really intense and really powerful. So there's many, many forms of agitation, but it's just basically a lot of activity. Like it just feels like we're kind of not grounded. We're kind of untethered somehow in experience. It's sort of how it feels. On the other side of the spectrum are feelings of what we call dullness. And that too can have a mental quality, but also a physical quality, or even a combination of the two. So mental is just when you feel kind of spaced out, your mind just isn't clear. It's kind of the opposite of that sort of wakeful feeling. You just really just feel unclear and cloudy, sometimes almost like a sort of a sleepy, foggy, kind of dense sort of feeling. But there's just sort of a lack of clarity. You just don't feel like, yeah, there's just sort of the opposite of that intense clarity experience. On the physical level, and I'm sure we've all had this one, is you just feel physically exhausted or lethargic. Like for me, the best example of this is if you've ever had really bad jet lag. It's a kind of thing, like I was just in Japan a few weeks ago and just got back last week. And there's this experience when your body just so intensely wants to sleep. For me, it's what happens at like 4 or 5 in the afternoon when I've gotten back from being on the other side of the planet. And my body is just so almost like painfully tired. You just want to go to bed, but you can't because you know it's going to mess up your sleep schedule. That's one example of it. But basically where the body, there's just like that heaviness, lethargy, tiredness, fatigue. Again, many variations of this that can happen, but it's more of a physical experience. It certainly affects the mind, but we feel it very physically. So those are two examples. And again, there are many other versions of unpleasant things that can happen, but those are kind of the two most commonly mentioned in meditative literature. So the important thing to realize is that we're experiencing these ups and downs. There's kind of two important points. One is to know that this is just a normal part of the meditative process. This is simply the inner system reworking itself, and kind of like it's almost like if you've never worked out in your life and you've been eating junk food and really unhealthy, and you say, okay, I'm going to make a change. And you start to go to the gym, you start to eat healthy, you try to get a better sleep habit and drink more water, all the things that we know are good for physical health. If you do that, you're going to suddenly have a whole bunch of changes. Some of them will feel better, but sometimes it won't feel good. You know, when you go to the gym for the first time, you'll be really sore. It'll be really hard when you're on the treadmill. It won't, you know, physically and perhaps even mentally, it won't feel pleasant, but you'll know it's a good part of the process because you're starting to get in shape. So it's really similar to that. It's just your body and mind are beginning to adjust to this process of getting in touch with one's Buddha nature, one's kind of training, whatever the case may be. So that's the first point, is just expect it. Like this is going to happen. It's normal. It's actually a good thing. Just as getting sore at the gym, even though it feels like physical pain, it's actually a good thing that it's happening. So if you feel that agitation, if you feel that dullness, if it feels like there's more emotional upheaval than normal, like any number of things that can happen, although it's unpleasant, that doesn't mean it's bad. Actually, it's a good sign because it's part, again, of this whole training process. So that's point one. This is normal. It's to be expected. Even the deeply unpleasant stuff is a good sign. It's just getting the right support, not pushing it, kind of trusting and being compassionate with yourself, not kind of, you know, pushing yourself past your limit, but just knowing that it's part of a wholesome process. The second thing that's really helpful to know about this is that everybody has a completely different version of this. And you can hear, you know, if you're part of a meditation community, or you read books, or even just like you hear people like me talking about this stuff, you might hear something like, well, I want that bursting out of my skin with joy thing. Like, why am I not getting that? I seem to only have like a lot of dullness and agitation, and I'm not having a lot of that blissful experience. Or, you know, one of your friends who started meditating suddenly has some, you know, wonderful experience that they tell you. And then we can immediately feel like, oh, maybe I'm not meditating right, or I'm not, you know, something else is, I'm not doing something else right. The way to look at this, again, to use the analogy of the journey, is that it's like you take 1,000 people and we're all going to San Francisco, but we're starting from different places on the planet. And so everybody's journey is going to look completely different. We're all going that same place. But, you know, if you're in Germany, you know, or you're in Japan, or you're in Argentina, or, you know, Botswana, or anywhere else, that journey is going to look completely different, right? And there's no right or wrong. The fact that I'm in Madison and I'm going to experience whatever the Madison airport and then get off the plane and whatever it is that I experience on my way to San Francisco, that's like the normal expected journey for me, because that's where I'm starting from. That's the context that I have. So if you're starting from Argentina and you're making that same trip, it shouldn't look like my journey. Like, that's, you are just starting from a different place. The circumstances of your journey will just completely necessarily look and feel radically different than my journey. And that's not right or wrong or better or worse. That is just your version of that. But it's still hard, because I think when we hear other people's journey, we tend to evaluate what's happening to us based on what we hear, on what we read, based on our expectations and ideals, all these kind of things that go on in our mind. And that's equally an important thing. It's just, we need to have the journey we're having, and just to know that that's going to look different. So the challenging thing is that, you know, for some people, there might not be a lot of like the pleasant yam. Like, some people might have no like bliss or like clarity. It might be like, I don't get that at all. Like, why am I not having those experiences? And again, that's just like the version, that's just based on the circumstances, the inner circumstances of your body and mind. It's, again, it's not good or bad. It just is, for whatever reason, for whatever causes and conditions are present in your life, it's just the natural outcome for your particular version of the path. So whether you have a lot of the unpleasant stuff and very little of the positive, or pleasant, or if you have a ton of the pleasant and not a lot of the negative, or you have a lot of both, or very little of neither, that's just your journey. It literally is neither here nor there. The path and the kind of key practice instruction that you'll hear from Mingyi Rinpoche and other teachers of the lineage, the only instruction really to deal with the ups and downs or the flat plane of all of that conditioned experience is just to let it be what it is and let it come and go, whatever it is. That's like really the only instruction. So you might have like psychic experiences where you feel like you have extrasensory powers, or you might just feel like you have a lot of physical pain. Like a lot of my practice throughout my life, I've had a ton of physical pain. Like, I've had a lot of back stuff and I've had all sorts of things, you know, and it could be like, it would have been really wonderful if I just had the unending bliss version of the path, but that's not what I had. But actually, I learned a tremendous amount through dealing with some chronic pain. I learned things that probably I never would have learned about myself, how to navigate inner experience, if I hadn't had that. Actually, it's been one of my greatest teachers. Most of you, if you've been around in these sessions, you've heard me talk about intense social anxiety. The beginning of my path, what started me on the path was like crippling anxiety. And that is my best teacher that I've had in my whole life. If I hadn't had that, like, it was utterly unpleasant, especially in my early days as a meditator. But that was my best teacher. I mean, I'm so grateful that I had that experience, because I learned things, and frankly, I learned them faster than if I hadn't had to deal with that. So again, sometimes the way things appear, and even if they're unpleasant, it might actually be profoundly transformative for us in a spiritual sense. The problem is it just doesn't feel like that. And we tend to think that the quote unquote pleasant experiences are also quote unquote positive experiences in a spiritual sense. But pleasant is completely uncorrelated from being positive and transformative in a spiritual sense. In fact, you could make an argument, and Rinpoche often says this, that we go farther, faster on the spiritual path with unpleasant experiences. He says things like, even practicing for a few minutes with like a really difficult experience, like chronic pain or a really, you know, our emotional demons and things like that. Even a few minutes of really sitting down and working with that in practice can be as transformative as months and months and months when things are going well. So working with unpleasant, the down part of the journey, is actually oftentimes where the real transformation is happening. And it just doesn't feel like that. It just doesn't feel pleasant and it doesn't feel good, but it's deeply, deeply transformative. So all of that is on the nyam end of the spectrum, these transitory meditative experiences. And a lot of the meditative process, kind of what we do on the path, is learning how to relate to that nyam, to those ups and downs of experience, in a wise, caring way. This is where we need wisdom and discernment. This is where we need a lot of self-compassion to go easy on ourselves, to know when we put our foot on the gas and go ahead, and where we just say, no, right now, I need to take a break. Right now is not the time to go barreling into this emotional stuff or these old memories. Right now, I just need to call a friend and go for a walk, or I just need to, you know, sometimes taking a break is the best thing to do in meditation practice. So we need that kind of self-compassion and patience with ourselves. We need the discernment, you know, when we can kind of, how to discern a high when we're on the peak of the mountain and when it's genuine realization. And if we kind of get those in place, then we were going to be able to navigate all that ups and downs skillfully. It's going to be a lot like that journey to San Francisco. And we just know we're going to be in lots of different places. It's going to look very different on Monday than it will on Wednesday and Saturday. It's going to be sometimes that we know will be difficult and other times that we'll, you know, be in some really amazing places. And you just expect it. You just know that's it. That's just the journey. On the other side of the spectrum is this other term that Rinpoche talks about in the teachings this month, which is realization. Realization is getting in touch with something that actually is not changing. So for example, these ups and downs of experience where we feel intensely wakeful one moment and then we feel dull and lethargic, that's all changing all the time, right? That is, if we look five times, you know, over the course of an hour or over the course of a day, we will feel different. We will feel wakeful one moment and not wakeful the next. And even if we're feeling wakeful, that itself won't always feel the same. We'll feel more intensely wakeful, less wakeful. It'll just be changing, right? But one thing that's not changing is that the knowing quality of the mind is always there. So regardless of whether we notice that we're really feeling dull, or we notice that we're intensely wakeful, we're noticing, right? We are able to notice that. We're even able to notice, there are practices where we train ourselves to notice when we're dreaming, for example, even in the state of sleep, or even, this might seem far-fetched if you're new to this idea, but even deep dreamless state, there are practices, and these are very advanced practices and not easy to do, where you can train yourself to recognize that knowing quality of mind, which is just noticing, right? That quality that allows us to notice something, even when we're asleep, even when we're dreaming, even in deep dream of sleep. Believe it or not, there is a thread of just bare consciousness that is there through all of those. It is not getting any better when we're intensely wakeful. It does not get any worse when we are really dull and lethargic and sleepy. It is not It is not improved or made worse by any of this. So every time you look at your experience, if you know how to look, you will find that knowing quality of mind, that capacity to notice things. And so that is what we're orienting to in Mahamudra practice. To use these analogies we hear all the time, it's like we're used to really paying all of our attention to the weather patterns in the sky. And we want some weather patterns. We try to get rid of other weather patterns. We like the calm, sunny days, and we don't like the hurricanes and the snowstorms. And so here, we're actually not paying attention. We're letting the weather patterns be whatever they are. And we're just getting in touch with the openness of the sky, the fact that the sky is just open and accommodating. It can equally accommodate a snowstorm and a blizzard, just as it can rainbows and nice fluffy white clouds. So you can spend your whole life trying to control the weather. And we have a lot of experience with that. And I don't know about you, but it probably hasn't gone so well for any of us. Or we can just change the paradigm and say, why don't we get in touch with the sky? That's basically what these practices are all about. So realization is just that process of getting in touch with the qualities of ourselves that don't change. And specifically this knowing presence of mind. Once you do that, and this is basically what we're doing in meditation practice, is you can start gaining insight into the very nature of awareness. So again, it's like getting to know, first you need to just notice that the sky is present. Normally theoretically we know it's present, but really we're caught up in the weather patterns. And now we're saying, okay, the sky is there too. Let's get in touch with the sky. So first you just are beginning to trust and to remember that it's there. But eventually you can actually start exploring the sky. Like, what actually is the sky? We know the qualities of the weather patterns, but what are the qualities of the sky itself? Like, the openness is obviously one of those qualities, right? The fact that it can accommodate anything and it doesn't seem to get worse or better with any of those weather patterns. That's another quality of the sky. So similarly, we just start getting in touch with the inner openness of our own mind and our own awareness, that sense that it can accommodate anything. That joyful, ecstatic experience can happen within awareness, and our inner demons that have been plaguing us our whole lives can happen. And awareness is just there. It doesn't get better or worse with any of that, right? So the whole point is that with these practices, we want to start orienting ourselves to the parts of ourselves that are kind of the most essential to who we are. So we don't get kind of caught up in trying to hold on to things that are kind of by their very nature going to change. So the nyam, these ups and downs of experience, those are conditioned, meaning they are based on causes and conditions that are contextual by their very nature. That is the very nature of those experiences. So trying to hold on to them, trying to have only pleasant ones and trying to get rid of the negative ones, it's just a losing game. It just doesn't work because by their very nature, they're always changing. So it's like trying to hold on to the weather patterns. You can try to force so it's always a sunny day, but that's not going to work. Nonetheless, that's what we do, right? That's oftentimes what we're trying to do in our lives. We're trying to control the weather all the time. So this is like maybe one of the most important distinctions in our entire lives, really, but certainly in our meditative lives, is to discern experience from realization. And with experience, again, I said the most important things, recognize that the changing, the ups and downs are normal. Everybody has it. Two, everybody has a different version of it. Yours is not going to be the same as the person next to you. And that's also to be expected. And then the key practice instruction is just let it be whatever it is. You can actually use whatever it is that's happening, as I talked about with my anxiety or physical pain or positive experiences, all those ups and downs you can use as an opportunity to get in touch with awareness. So if you shift your relationship from trying to control the experiences to using them as a gateway to start seeing these more essential qualities, then you're learning to shift from experience to realization. Your orientation begins to shift. So that's kind of the key distinction. And we're going to hear, if you haven't gotten to this point in the course, Rinpoche has some great teachings on this. And look at this in your own practice. You know, my guess is many of you have already been working with this dynamic, but it's just an incredibly helpful lens to have into your experience when you sit down to meditate, or even when you're just bringing your practice into your life. Notice when you're trying to control the weather patterns, you know, when you're trying to just stay on the peak of the mountain and not acknowledging that there's going to be the periods in the valley and the swamp. And instead, see if you can just shift to the qualities that are always going to be there for you, no matter where you are and the ups and downs. And just noticing that itself, I think, can just be a really, really helpful tip. So why don't we call it a day there? And we've got about 10 minutes left. Maybe we can just end with a little discussion. If you have any thoughts, any reflections, any questions, you can either put them in the chat or you can raise your hand. I'll kind of, maybe I need to change the settings here just a moment. Okay, Ray, you've got your hand up. What's on your mind?
Yes, here I am. You were talking about sleep a little sooner, and I am in this pattern of monitoring my sleep since about a year with Oura, actually. That's very interesting because you learn about the periods of deep sleep and surface sleep and so on. But there's something very interesting. I realized that the deep sleep period that I have that changed from one day to another, which is fantastic, actually, are those periods that I am absolutely unaware of. Because, of course, we know, we learn that this is the moment in our sleep, the body is paralyzed, we don't have any movement, we're fixed, kind of. And I can remember the paradoxical sleep because dreams happens there. I know when it happens during the night. But these moments of deep sleep, what tell us again, what happened to the mind in these deep sleep? Of course, we don't remember. To me, sometimes it looks like a previous life. This is something that I go through, but I have no clue of what happened in that dark chamber I crossed.
Yeah, yeah. So this is fascinating terrain, and we could have, I mean, not only a whole session, we could have like a whole long, long series of kind of explorations just on basically the different states of consciousness we experience. And there's something really telling about kind of where we live from, kind of our where we are kind of rooted in our experience from how we experience deep dreamless sleep. So, you know, according to the sort of the tradition, the way this is presented, you know, in a very kind of traditional Buddhist sense, is that we have all of these different layers of consciousness. And in like, for example, if you just look now, we have our kind of sensory experience, right? Like all everything, what we see, hear, feel, taste, touch, and so on, which is the world of the senses. Then we have the world of our kind of the inner world of our thoughts and emotions, or kind of between that, like the inner sensory experiences in the body, more subtle than that, like our thoughts and emotions. And that's basically where we live most of our lives. It's we're completely, our conscious experience is consumed with all of that stuff, the sensory experience and the interplay between like our emotional and thought experience and our sensory experience. And we're kind of in that space. That's like where we live. When we fall asleep, we go through this process, and it's very similar. One of the interesting things about it is that it's said to mirror the process that happens when, of like the dying process, actually. So learning to get in touch with this kind of process helps us get in, like train ourselves so we can be more conscious when we go through the dying process. But in any case, essentially what happens is all of the stuff that we normally live from, like starting with the sensory experience, going to this inner experience of the body, and then the more, even more subtle experience of the world of thoughts and imagery in the mind and emotions and so on. Basically in the sleep process, it kind of gets more and more subtle. We first, you know, kind of let go of the outer sensory world. We lose touch of that. And that's like this period where like your mind just starts this weird kind of tumult of thoughts and images. And we're kind of fascinated by that. And then that sort of dissolves. And then it basically gets more and more and more subtle until actually there's nothing left but like this bare elemental consciousness or awareness itself. But because we live our conscious experience in all this other stuff, we have not trained ourselves to recognize that, that kind of most simple experience. So we just kind of lose touch with it. It's there, but we are not recognizing it in the same way that we're not recognizing it perhaps now and in many moments of our lives where, you know, you're hearing my voice, you might be have thoughts and other things, but we haven't trained ourselves to stay with that very subtle, bare knowing quality of the mind when it's not, doesn't have all this other stuff going on. But what the tradition says is that we can. We actually can train ourselves. And in many ways, that's what awareness practice is doing. It's just the most subtle form of that. So it's really hard to recognize. In fact, when you recognize it at first, you might not even kind of know. It's almost like you, like the first thing that's happening is we're just like retaining that connection. And we at first like don't even recognize that's happening during the sleep process. But what's there's beginning, like the connection is being made between the capacity to recognize and the consciousness itself. And the only signs that are happening is that dreams don't happen when that happens. The second one is that like you wake up, you actually wake up meditating. And like this can actually happen where like literally, unlike you kind of wake up and you're slowly coming back to consciousness, it's that boom, it's like you wake up and you're already in the state of meditation. Like that's the first kind of step of that process. But eventually you actually, the familiarity grows such that actually you can still feel like more conscious, like you're actually conscious in the state of deep sleep itself. And there's all sorts of practices that sort of unfold from that point. So that's just the most subtle form of consciousness, but it's not too dissimilar from, for example, having a strong emotional experience. And normally most people can't experience an emotional outburst without losing the groundedness and awareness. But we can have that moment. In fact, I can remember in my life the first time I actually was angry and then suddenly was like vividly aware in the middle of anger, not like right after. And it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like I suddenly started, it was weird because I was in an argument. So this was like a really long time ago, but I remember it vividly. I was like in an argument with somebody, with my partner at the time. And we were like intensely like angry at the time and like, you know, arguing about something. And suddenly I just had this moment of awareness. And I started like I couldn't stop laughing. And I remember she was like, what are you like, what is going on here? But like it completely blasted apart the whole thing. And I was like, oh my God, you know, and it seems like a simple thing. Of course you can be aware and you can train yourself, but normally we're not, right? Like normally you get caught up in emotion and it's like after, you know, you're lucky if like you can remember it. So it's fundamentally, it's not different than that. It's just like any other moment. We're just learning to come back to awareness, but in increasingly kind of subtle or habitually dense experiences. So anyways, this is a really fascinating terrain. There's a lot more we could say, but.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. Being in retreat sometime for a long period, I remember that during my sleep, when you fall asleep, you lose track very quickly. I know, yeah. I become very drowsy and then poof, I'm gone. And the interesting part is that being in retreat, I would wake up all the time, all night, during the dreams as well as during the very light sleep, and the practices that I was doing during the daytime was there. I mean, the text was reciting by itself in my mind. Yeah. I would wake up in a meditation, almost in a meditation posture. Sometime I felt it, and then I would realize I'm in bed. It's amazing. But this very, very, I would call it solid dark period. These are the one I cannot connect with.
And you hear lots in the tradition. I mean, there's even this famous story. I don't have time to tell the whole thing, but basically about the 16th Karmapa who basically was saying something like he was talking to some famous scholar and he was asking the scholar something like, yeah, you know, basically I have like seamless awareness day and night. The only point is like right when I fall asleep, like right at that moment when all the consciousness is dissolved and the switch into that deep dreamless, like that's the one moment I somehow am still losing consciousness for a moment in that one moment. And of course the scholar was like, like, this is above my pay grade if you're like, I have like 1 second where you can't retain awareness. So anyway,
that's the bardo of sleep.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ray. Irene, what's on your mind?
I have a question about sort of daily practice in regards to not manipulating experience. So during normal practice, usually like I start with nature of mind practice in the morning, and I tend to not have much in terms of negative nyams. But often after, just after in my, you know, exchanges with my partner, I maybe like my experience may be really sharp. And then I may be kind of, you know, kind of a, maybe too sharp in my behavior. And then I kind of manipulate and I do a later practice where I think like a longer practice where I think, okay, I need to pacify a bit so I'm a nicer person. And then I tend to do Tara practice or Avalokiteshvara practice because of the peaceful quality. So, and I do intersperse it with nature, you know, of just dropping the visualization and just being there. But I just wonder, like, is that manipulating too much? But my intention is really that I'm more decent, you know. But of course, it is in a way manipulating.
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's this famous quote which you've probably heard, Irene, that's kind of like, you know, we can lose the view in our application or conduct, or we can lose our application or conduct in the view. And basically what this is pointing to is balance. So one thing, basically we can hear, like, one way to sort of be too kind of rigid or extreme in practice is we kind of hear teachings, especially like nature of mind teachings like this, can also happen with emptiness teachings. And then we kind of think, oh, okay, like, you know, it's effortless, it's empty. Like I just basically should just let everything be as it is sort of radically. And therefore I'm not going to change anything ever. And so like, and then, you know, you're with your partner or you're in daily life or whatever. And it can be almost like, oh, well, then I shouldn't, if I'm angry, I'm just going to shout and yell. And I'm like, that's just what's happening naturally. So I'm just going to do that. Or I'm going to, like, you basically kind of go too extreme where you're really not sensitive, you know, to just basically the workings of karma. Like that this is like, we're still living in the relative world. You know, we have our suffering, other people's suffering, and we're still operating in that world of causes and conditions. On the other extreme is where we kind of lose the view. Like we forget all about that view of like, this is our true nature. There's part of us that is fundamentally pure, that doesn't need, you know, that's beyond all these causes and conditions. We just forget all about that. And we're just endlessly trying to make a better samsara, right? Like we're just, you know, you might be very sensitive with your partner and doing all the right things and very kind, but you just completely lose the view at the same time. And I think what the tradition says, which is, it's, I think, so helpful and profound, is that really what we need is we need, on the one hand, you know, a lot of the practice is just staying with the view. Whether you're meditating or you're with your partner, you can still recognize that there's part of you, part of your partner, part of the world. Like this fundamental purity is who we are. And at the same time, the path is such that we're losing touch with that, right? We get, and when that happens, we're in the world of causes and conditions, and we need to respect that. We need to be sensitive to that. So as a practitioner, what that means is that, and this is not, look, this itself is something we need to learn to do. It's like riding the bike. You kind of are learning different pieces of it, and eventually you can put it all together and just ride. The beginning, it takes some work to do this. But, you know, say you're, you know, you're at the breakfast, you're having breakfast with your partner or whatever, and it's that time when you can be a little sharper than normal. You can at the same time hold the view, like kind of remind yourself, yeah, okay, this is who I am. This is who they are. This is like our true nature. I want to stay grounded in this. And at the same time, I have habits, right? I have like this old habitual stuff that's coming up. So you can learn to kind of hold the view at the same time and work skillfully. Like sometimes it might be helpful. Like, yeah, okay. Like it's, you know, bringing a little Waitara energy is maybe helpful here. Like, and hold the view of like nature of mind or, you know, whatever is the helpful view for you. You can kind of hold that in mind while using the tools you have to work with relative reality in a skillful way. And this is exactly what you see with like the great masters of the tradition, where, you know, great, like I just talked about the 16th Karmapa, for example, or, you know, great master like, you know, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche or Drudgen Rinpoche, or, you know, you hear about these great teachers, and they were using these practices too. Like they were, you know, by all accounts, living Buddhas, you know, who were completely there with awareness and resting, but they were still doing Waitara. You know, if the 16th Karmapa needed to do Waitara, then, you know, probably we need to keep working with Waitara too, right? But I think the key is like, you can still stay with the view, like really try to, like the question would be, how can you do that while recognizing that the true Waitara actually is your own awareness? Like that's the true Waitara. And then the more relative Waitara is like the peaceful energy and the, so it's kind of like, it's this integration of the view and then just being skillful and kind and compassionate and using the tools we have in the world, but kind of staying rooted in that. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Irene. So let's do one more. Jared, you've got your hand up.
In your analogy, which I've heard many times of going from Minneapolis to San Francisco, it implies sort of that once I get to San Francisco, then I've arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And I now get the feeling that there's no arrival, that it's, you know, it's an ongoing trip in a sense. I just wondered if you'd speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. Another great question. And a good one to end on too. The Rinpoche likes to say that no example fits perfectly. If the example fit the reality perfectly, it wouldn't be the example. It would be the actual thing. So there's always like some things that work about the example and some things that don't. I'm going to break the example by saying this, but like, if you were really trying to get it closer to the reality, actually, we're already in San Francisco.
Right.
basically what's happening is we think we're like in Madison and I need to go all the way there, but suddenly we realize actually I was in San Francisco all along is like kind of what happens. If you want to, that of course breaks the metaphor a bit, but that is the other piece of this, and that's certainly where the analogy breaks down, is that part of what happens on this journey in a very kind of real human kind of felt terms is that I think we start we start from a place of where we really feel like we're not, like we might intellectually understand, somebody can tell us we're already there, this is who we truly are, we have all these awakened qualities, whatever, and we can get like, that's not hard to understand intellectually, but honestly, I mean, I think for most of us, certainly me, like we don't really feel like that. Like, honestly, like, we don't really believe that. We still think, okay, yeah, like, that's nice in a theory and maybe someday, whatever. But right now, I still have my emotional garbage and my, you know, I still get, you know, I have my short temper or I'm too anxious or blah, 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 whatever. You know, we have our things and there's part of us that just fundamentally doesn't believe that. And what begins to happen is that, you know, we might have enough openness that we're just willing to kind of entertain the idea and be on the path, you know, over time, there start to be glimpses where we actually sort of experience that. And we start to see, oh, you know, there's part of me that I actually experienced for a moment, you know, when I was with a teacher or I was reading a book and I suddenly had this moment or, you know, like whatever, like I had a moment, like one that always stands out to me is I was doing a retreat in Burma for a month and it was really painful. It was like, I don't want to say the worst retreat. It was the hardest retreat. It was just like so hard. Like it was just like sitting there, like gritting my teeth for like 12 hours a day. It was like so deeply unpleasant. It was so not fun for like a month. If I hadn't been in Burma, I would have freaking just left and run somewhere. But it was like, I was in Burma. Where was I going to go? So anyways, I was stuck there. But there was one period in that where like, I think because it was so unpleasant, I had so much physical pain and all this stuff going on, that there was this moment where it was suddenly like, oh, like it broke through. And I was, for me, the huge insight was pain without suffering. And I just suddenly, you know, it wasn't the whole retreat. It was actually just a few hours on like amidst a month of like pain and suffering, basically. But that couple hours was like, a revelation. It was like, oh my God, I still am hurting, but I feel okay. Like I was in touch with that fundamental okayness. For the first time, I really felt that. And then I could go back to the pain and suffering, but I knew that that was a possibility for me, right? And then everything begins to change because you start saying, oh my God, like it's like everything they've been saying is true. Like I can be in the world, even with my neurotic emotions and even with my extremely imperfect body and all these different things that I think are wrong with me and the world and everything else. And actually there is something that actually is fundamentally okay in all of that. I'm just, my habit is to not be conscious of that, to not be with that. And then the whole game begins to shift. And then it's like, oh, I'm actually in San Francisco, right? Like you start realizing that that whole journey, the journey becomes different. And instead of getting to San Francisco, it's just learning to remember that you're in San Francisco. You know, the metaphor kind of doesn't work anymore, but that's really what it is, to just remember. So anyways, there's a whole lot to say about this, but that's a big shift, is like that whole paradigm from going to something to sort of exploring what's already here. And just the habitual energy pulling us away from that in a million different ways. But that's the messiness of the path, is just kind of navigating that terrain. So yeah, thanks for pointing that out, because it does, the analogy is helpful in ways, but can also give us a misimpression in other ways. So it's a good point. So good discussion. I hope there was something in there that was helpful for you. This was these teachings are just so precious and beautiful. I hope you're finding them helpful, as I certainly have in my life. And hopefully we'll have another discussion like this sometime soon. I imagine you've also been attending, especially if you're newer to this program, just a plug. Of course, Mingyur Rinpoche's teachings, goes without saying, are just incredibly helpful. I also just wanted to say, we are incredibly lucky to have people like Tim and Kunsung in our community. They are two of the most wise, kind, compassionate beings. I mean, I know them very well. And you get to know people behind the scenes. It's one thing when you can show up in a webinar and, you know, say some seemingly, you know, profound things. It's another thing behind the scenes, just day to day, like what are people actually like? And I can just tell you, these are two just legitimately amazing people who are really as kind and wonderful as they appear on a webinar, as that's like really how they are. So just to plug, if you haven't been going to the webinars and practice sessions, they are just really wise, wonderful people. So if you haven't connected with them, I would strongly recommend it. So wherever you are in the world, have a wonderful evening, day, and I look forward to connecting with you soon. So take care, everyone. And our ritual is usually I like to put Zoom in gallery mode and ask everybody just to unmute themselves and just say hello and goodbye. It's nice to just hear everybody's voice. So if you want to do that.
Thank you so much.
Be well. Have a great night. Have a great day.